I believe in that love.
My name's Jill. I'm an addict alcoholic. And I don't know how I got here, but I just got here, and I knew I wasn't going to make it, you know, and this is like my first time I ever spoke. Can you guys hear me? No? Good. I wasn't saying anything too much important anyway. I just had trouble finding here, and by a coincidence, I ran into somebody in the fifth chapter, and they gave me direction. I followed him here, and he got me more lost. And I don't know how I got here on time, but it was right on time, I guess. You guys, it was a little late. It was a little nerve-wracking. I'm kind of, you know, like grinding my teeth and stuff. And what I really need to do is like a third-step prayer, you know? And what I'd like to do is, like, I'd like to say a part of it and have you repeat it after me, you know? Because, like, maybe somebody else or half you people could probably use it, you know? And just to kind of mellow me out a little bit. And so if you could repeat after me, God, I offer myself to you to build with me and to do with me as you will. Relieve me from the bondage of self that I may better do your will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those that I would help of thy power, thy love, thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Amen. All right. And I'm from Walnut Creek, California, the home of sunshine and snobs. And I've been clean and sober for a little over 5 years. And you can tell by looking at me, I didn't, you know, have to go out like for 30 or 40 years, you know. I drank as long as I could possibly drink. by the time I was... 22 years old, I had already had 3 drunk drivings. I've been shot in a solar plex. I've had over 2,000 stitches around the stomach alone, and I've had hepatitis, and was in AA for about 2 years before I got more than 2 days back-to-back clean and sober. And once you go to AA, it just kind of interferes with your drinking and using. And every time you get loaded, you think of them little AA slogans. And I went to my first meeting when I was 19 with my dad, and he kept on saying, "One's too many, a thousand's not enough. Gates of insanity or death." And I swear, any kind of drug or alcohol I do, no matter how loaded I'd be, you know, that would kind of run across the old brain, you know, and it just wasn't very comfortable, you know. And I was just going crazy and crazy, and I couldn't take it anymore. And I went through an awesome amount of pain to get here, believe it or not. I mean, you can't tell by looking at this pretty face. And you can tell I'm also real humble. But it hurts, you know, to get here. And sometimes it hurts to stay. I couldn't wait to get 5 years sobriety, you know. I just couldn't wait. It was like the thing to get, you know. And my dad said, don't, you know. Don't put, like, any length of sobriety to get, because once you get it, and then you get the 5 years, and that's it. And I said, right. He had 2 years, and he went and got loaded. And then I came back to see him, and he was drinking, and I had about a year. And then I came back, and he got sober again. And he was a big idol to me. You know, he was a real good-looking guy. He looked exactly like me, and he had a real good sense of humor, and I love him, you know, and he died about September 24th, and it was like real hard for me to accept, you know, and it still messes with me a little bit, you know, because there wasn't very many people in this world that I really loved with all my heart, that I looked up for. He was bigger than life, you know. And I lost a lot of people this year, you know, or last year. I lost Jay Marino. He was I don't know, 9 years clean and sober, and we were both purebred Geminis, and he was born on the 10th, and I was on the 11th, and he told me, you know, I could be clean and sober and crazy, you know, and I can, and I do it to the best of my ability, and I have extreme awesome amount of fun, you know. There's nowhere I can't go, there's nowhere I can't be. And he got ran over by a drunk driver on July 24th. And it was hard to accept, but it's just one of the things in Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me, to accept the unacceptable. And I met my first love in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was about 10 months sobriety, and I had the perfect program. Nobody in Alcoholics Anonymous had a better program than I did. I had completed all 12 steps to the best of my ability, and God put this newcomer girl in my life. And you hear people around say, yeah, you can't mess with newcomers. And that's fine for them, because they didn't have the kind of program I had. And I wasn't, you know, I did a little inventory checking around, and I wasn't going to let this cute little thing get messed around by these guys around here. You know, and so I ran to her rescue. I knew I could cure her, and she didn't get more than two months clean and sober the 2 years that we went around together. And I don't know how I stayed clean and sober, and it was painful, and it's the only time I've ever been in love, and I haven't had the guts to try to fall back into it after that. And I shop around. I tell God, yeah, I'm ready, God. Bring one in my life not so new, and maybe not in AA. And so they're okay, and they bring them there, and it's like they're the ones until 2 weeks, and then they're not the ones anymore. And that's like, I don't know what that is. It's just a sex problem, I guess. Okay, I don't know how much time I have here, but I'll just kind of breeze through the steps real quick. I really, like it says in the big book, know deep within myself that I am without a doubt truly powerless over alcohol and drugs, and my life is still very unmanageable, you know. I proved it by being here just late, you know. That's real low class too. I'm like known as Joe Cool and stuff, and they said, well, leave it to this, you know, I know what they were thinking, leave it to this clown, you know, to be late like this, you know, this is some serious stuff here. This is a matter of life and death, and all they see me is crack jokes and try to pick up on chicks. And that's not the way it is. Like, I do that, and, but I also work a program, and I'm honest, you know, and I'm this, and like, why, like on the powerlessness, why do something if it beats me every time? You know, like if I ate strawberries and I broke out and it made me real ugly and stuff, I wouldn't eat them anymore, you know. And I drink that booze and the drugs, and I just drink it, and it just whip me every time. And it just like I'd go back for more. I'd wait for 2 days, let my body build back up, and go do it again. And it's just like, why do I keep on doing that? And I couldn't figure it out. I should have got here when I was 16 years old. I'd be really good looking then. And the second step is the one that you guys all know about me, is that, you know, no human power could restore me to sanity, but God could and would if he sought. And as we know, it's like not an instant step, like God just didn't zap me and I'm like all sane now, because I'm still real wacko, you know. I'm still not all there, you know. I'm missing a few cards. I don't have both oars in the water. I think one's broke. And I spin around in circles sometimes, and then a good wave comes and shoves me down, you know, shoves me down the river a little ways. But I have faith that God could and would restore me to sanity in his time. You know, I'm kind of like my crazy old self. You know, I don't have too much of a choice but to like it. And it's been with me this far, and I'm starting to kind of get a kick out of it now, you know, with this crazy dude upstairs, a committee. And I heard these one people at this meeting, they were kind of a little bit crazier than I was, and they said, when that committee starts talking, They'll slap themselves on top of the head like that, and they feel like that knocked the committee around the table off their chairs, and it takes them a couple minutes to climb back on their chairs. And I... Really, and if you try that, it really works, but, you know, I have like this look good, and I ain't going to walk around the street going bam, bam, bam like that. But in case you really get tired of it and really get mad, just slap yourself in the head. It gives you a headache sometimes. But it's just there to entertain you, you know. It's there when it's boring, you know. And the third step is, you know, what we did at the beginning of the meeting, and that's like a real powerful step. And I do it like a lot of times. And to turn my will and my life over the care of God as I understand Him or as I don't understand Him. And, you know, like God, Jehovah, Jesus, in the name of, you know, Jesus and all that stuff. And you get all religious and then you leave Alcoholics Anonymous and then you come back. If you make it back. And it's like I was born, I guess, a Southern Baptist. And then I went Protestant, Presbyterian, Catholic, and Jehovah Witness. And I'm nothing now. I'm just a God believer, and I don't go to church. It confuses me, and it's either the church or AA, and I pick AA. You know, at least I can cuss once in a while. You know, and we don't have no big heavy rules. You know, except for don't mess with newcomers and don't take nothing during the. You know, we can't use no dope here and stuff like that. And that's cool, you know, because there's no sense on me being up here when everybody's lower on weed or some acid or, you know, something like that or volumes and sleeping through me, you know. And I think that's one of the problems I had getting clean and sober is not enough people said you can't use any drugs here, Joe. A few people did, but they weren't the kind of people I wanted to listen to. I wanted the people to say, go ahead and smoke weed. It's good for you. And so I did, and that's why I couldn't get more than 2 days back-to-back clean and sober for 2 years. And the fourth step is I did it my first time within my first 30 days of sobriety, and it's like I feel like the only reason that's why I'm sober is because I was able to do that and be forgiven for all them sinful things I did in the past. You know, because I did a lot of crazy things, believe it or not. I know I look like a true virgin up here. But, you know, I've been wanting to have sex and stuff like that since I've been about 4 years old. And it's hard to find girls to do it with, so you hit on your nieces and cousins and stuff, and then you feel kind of guilty about it when they grow up, you know? So you can write about stuff like that, and, you know, and you get forgiven about it, you know? And you don't have to, you know, you don't have to see them and say, hey, you don't have that big wall between them, you know. And then on the 8th and 9th, you get to say, yeah, I'm sorry for trying to do that when we were 5 and 6 and 7 and 8 years old. And then you forgive them about, you know, for not giving it up when you really could then, you know. And I've done, you know, like the fourth is just being willing to have God remove all your defects. Made a fearless and searching moral inventory of ourselves. And I haven't did one for about a year and a half or 2 years, but I did one like every 6 months, you know, when I first came in. And I'm about ready for another one. It's like, I don't do it like what it says in the big book. I just kind of have like a bitch list, you know. It's just like what's wrong in my life, you know. And that's just the way that I do it, and that's the way it works for me, you know. And you can make it, you know, like Hazleton and get it real complicated and 440 pages and all that stuff, and I just, you know, put about 2-3 pages together about all the deep, dirty stuff that I did in sobriety, because, you know, just because we're in sobriety don't mean that we don't get sleazy sometimes, you know. And then just admitting it to God and to another human being. And my sponsor is kind of a square guy. He always tries to turn me into a square guy, get me going to church, and he never wants me to have a mustache or long hair, stuff like that, you know. And but after I've kept on staying sober, he gave up on that kind of stuff and just let me kind of be me, you know. And that's, you know, I really love that man. I did about four steps with him. And then the sixth and seventh, I used to think that was like an easy step because you really didn't have to do anything. All you had to do was become willing to have God remove all your defects of character. And then, you know, the eighth is just humbly, the seventh is humbly asked him to remove them. And I had to do the sixth and seventh when I had about 6 months because I was trying to get one of the miracle programs. And this lady told me, Joe, you're never going to make it. And she had like 10 years sobriety. She said, Joe, you're never going to make it unless you stop acting so cool. You know, I'd always go into a meeting late with loud boots, you know. And look at the person that was talking and just go, oh, wow. And so I just happened to be on the 6 and 7 steps. So I said, well, I should look into that. And then I went to a meeting, and it was like about one-third this size. But it was like a pretty big meeting for me. And I, you know, I was like a lost part of this dark circles under my eyes. And about 200 pimples disappeared, and I still had about 40, I think. And I was, you know, new clothes, and it's like heavy stuff. And I come strutting through this big meeting, and I knew everybody was saying, gee, that Joe looks nice. Geez, look at that guy. He's really coming around, isn't he? And, you know, they were probably just talking about their wife and kids and stuff like that, but I thought everybody was looking at me and talking about me. So I sat down real perfect and not one wrong move, and just sitting there just with a slight lean, a kink to the neck, and looked like super sobriety. And my hair was kind of longer then. And they go, well, we'll open the meeting in a moment of silence followed by the serenity prayer. And I, you know, listened for the moment of silence. And during the moment of silence, some guy from a recovery house, I guess he ate some bad food or something, but I just went like that. And but as everybody heard it and everybody started laughing, you know. Except for me, I just said, that's a, you know, that's about the lowest thing you can do in Alcoholics Anonymous is fart during the moment of silence in the serenity prayer. So everybody's just laughing their, you know, their things off. And I go, this is disgusting. These people really are sick. So they start reading how it works, and you hear a little giggle here and there, and it starts dying out, you know, and about, they finished with how it works, and they start reading the 12 traditions, and all of a sudden, I think about that, and I said, you know, that is kind of funny, you know? And I said, don't dare laugh, Joe, because nobody's laughing here anymore. But this laughter wanted to come out so bad, but I couldn't, you know? It was just like, I ain't going to just start laughing out loud, you know? I said, yeah, I knew that guy was bad, you know, and I just cared so much what happened, and, I couldn't help it, and I had like a stuffed up nose, and I'm trying to hold back this laugh, and it just shot out my nose. And I was smoking a cigarette at the time, and I caught it in my hand, and I like put out the cigarette, and all my hair fell in front of my face, and I couldn't see, you know? And I didn't know if my coffee was up straight or sideways. The only way I could tell was like when it was burning my leg. And the lady next to me goes, Joe, would you like me to get you a Kleenex? And I just, And I was like, I was helpless, you know. I was like, just no place to go. I was just like, I'm just glad, you know, not that many people have seen me. But, you know, quite a few did. And that, you know, and then plus that lady telling me you can't act so cool and that stuff. I just said, well, that's it, God. I don't ever want to act cool again. I begged him. I begged him for about a month straight with tears in my eyes, with all sincerity. God, please take this coolness away. I can't take it anymore. And I'll do anything you want. I mean, you know, anything. Just I want to be clean and sober. And if the only way I can do it is not being cool, then don't make me cool no more. I'll be a square just like the rest of these jerks, you know? And the only thing I could think of is God said, Joe, I'm sorry, we can't take that away. Just a little bit of time. At least that's what I hope he said. Because that's what I went on. And I felt like maybe if he did take all this coolness away, I'd be like the invisible man. It was just like, who would I be? And so I'm still like extremely cool, you know? But down deep, I'm just a regular, you know, city slick and oaky, you know, with a sense of humor that's a nice person, that's a bad person, that's a biker, a jock, and an athlete, and a wannabe singer, but can't sing, and just I'm a lot of different things, you know, and I just like when I was drinking, I had to be like one person, you know, just like I had to be kind of like a semi-biker country and western guy, you know. And here, like, I can style out, you know, and then I brought my motorcycle, so tomorrow I might put on my leather chaps and be biked out like a Hell's Angel, you know. And then maybe go jogging after that or before that or whatever, you know. It's just like, I really can't just make myself one thing. Just say, Joe, you're a biker, now be a biker, you know what I mean? Just, you like motorcycles, so be that way. Or, Joe, you like jogging, you like working out with weights, and just do that, you know, don't do nothing else, you know. I was just like, you're an Okie, Joe, so talk like an Okie and hang around with Okies. And it's just like, I can't do all that, you know. It's like, I'm real slick, and it's like, Joe, do that. And it's just like, I just like to do everything, you know. And I do it, you know, and I have fun doing it. And I think the worst thing you can do to an alcoholic is try to tell him to live up to his expectation of himself, you know. Just like, if that's what you want to be, that's who you are. And that's the way I feel, you know, is like, I'm me. And with all them people, I'm a Gemini, I'm supposed to be two people. I feel about 15. And the eighth and ninth step is like, on sixth and seventh, I, you know, believe God, you know, will take my personal defects of character away in time. He has taken a lot of my coolness away. I believe now that I'm not Jesus Christ, and I'm not going to be like a real important person in society. You know, like I'm not going to be like President of the United States, well-known politician, you know, person of a, you know, that's going to take over the world and stuff. Because that's the kind of, my ego always told me that, you know. And the eighth and ninth step is just making amends. And first it's become willing to make amends, and then it's the hard part is making the amends. And I haven't made, like, all my amends. There's amends that the guy that shot me, you know what I mean? It's like, I can't go to wherever he's at because I put him away, you know, and I feel kind of guilty about putting him away. I mean, I was 19 and he was 35, but we were still behind the kind of life we were in. And it's like, I can't tell him, you know, I'm sorry for putting you in jail, you know. Oh, that's a nice Timex watch there, that guy's showing. But, you know, you're convinced, I'm convinced, you know, the steps work, and it's about 20 minutes, and I got this little thing here that helps me a lot. It's called the old violin. And it was battered and scarred, and the auctioneer thought it was scarcely worth his while to waste his time on the old violin, but he held it up with a smile. What am I bidding, good people, he cried, who'll start the bidding for me? $1, not two, only two, $2, who'll make it three? $3 once, $3 twice, going for three, but no. From the room far back, a gray-haired man came forward and picked it up the bow. Then wiping the dust from the old violin and tightening up the strings, he played a melody pure and sweet as an angel sings. The music ceased, and the auctioneer, with a voice that was quite low, said, what am I bid for the old violin, as he held it up with a bow? $1,000, who'll make it two? $2,000, who'll make it three? $3,000 once, $3,000 twice, going and gone, said he. The people cheered, some of them cried, we don't quite understand. What changed the worth swiftly came, the reply, the touch of the master's hand. And many a man with life out of tune is auctioned to a thoughtless crowd. Much like the old violin, a mess of pottage, a glass of wine, a game, and he travels on. He's going once, he's going twice, and he's going and almost gone. But the master comes, and the foolish crowd never can quite understand the worth of a soul, the change that's wrought by the touch of the master's hands. Thank you, God bless you, and keep coming back.
I had an opportunity to introduce our speaker 3 years ago at a Fallen Leaf Lake conference. And I knew she was speaking here tonight. And I was thinking yesterday, wouldn't it be neat if I could introduce her again? The chairperson did not show up tonight. And I was asked 5 minutes before the meeting to introduce Cindy A. And it's with a pleasure I do so.
Thank you. My name is Cindy. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's good to be here tonight. Looks like maybe I'm the 10-minute speaker. It's been one of those days. Move it down like that. How's that? Okay. It's been one of those days where I've had a lot of opportunities to either do what we call out in Southern California, go with the flow, or dig in my heels and resist what's happening. Because there was a wreck on the freeway, so we were late to the airport. But that didn't matter because the plane was an hour late. So we were late getting here. Then we couldn't find our room. Then they couldn't find our turkey sandwich. It's hard to tell what's going to happen from this point on. I really never know. I would like to say that I'm always glad to be at a group like this. I've had some remarkable experiences in Alcoholics Anonymous, and some of them just sort of flowed through me. Tony and I shared a lot 3 years ago at Fallen Leaf Lake, and it's wonderful to see him again. When you go to conferences fairly regularly, it's remarkable how people come in and out of your life. It convinces me more and more of something I have come to know over the years since I've been with you, and that is my total conviction and belief that there are no accidents and no mistakes. I'm often challenged on that issue. People like to tell me a lot about the mistakes they have made and the bad decisions they've made, the poor breaks they've had in life, the difficulties that have befallen them. I know in looking back over my own experience of drunkenness and sobriety that I could not be here tonight without any of that, without all of that. As a matter of fact, if I were given an opportunity to fix my life, to somehow change it, I have a feeling I would probably change the wrong thing and be somewhere else tonight doing something else. So I would not change any of the experiences I've had. A very important man in my life is here tonight, a man who has gone through a lot of what I will share with you tonight with me. And we seem to end up together in a lot of strange places and strange ways, too. That's what life is like for me today, an opportunity to see what happens. When I came to you in January of 1972, I was a drunken junkie. In April of 1973, I began to stay sober one day at a time and have managed to do that ever since. I became, at that time, an addict and an alcoholic. For me, that was a remarkable movement into health and wholeness. I experience myself today as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I experience that as my continuing growth and continuing recognition of my wellness. I hear a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous talk about how sick we are. And I know today that I have everything I have because it's what I want. I have exactly what I came to Alcoholics Anonymous to get. That's why I have it. In the last 10 years and 9 months of my sobriety, I have spent a lot of time trying to figure out why I have some of the things I have, because it seems like I don't want them. But I know better than that. I know I have everything I want. That's why it's there. And the only way to change some of the events and experiences in my life are to examine how I keep bringing into my life the same kinds of things over and over. I have come to have a new happiness and a new freedom in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have learned to hear things in a new way. By the time I got to you, I really had very little left. And the fact is, as I understand it today, you don't need to have very much left when you get to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. As a matter of fact, we do better than any group of people in the world with almost nothing. And that's what I brought to you, almost nothing. I had managed to lose and eliminate everything from my life that had ever been important. I had lost the right to raise my only son. I had lost the right to go to university. I had lost the right to participate in my life as I had hoped to take part in it. I had lost everything inside of me. And I was convinced that I had come to you about 20 minutes too late, that there was not enough left of me for you to work with. And fortunately, you did not believe that, even though I told you quite regularly that there wasn't enough left and that I could never care again or love again and that I did not care about you. It didn't bother you at all. You didn't seem to mind that I did not love you. That as a matter of fact, all I wanted was what you had. What I didn't know was that all you have is love, and it's all you ever gave me. And that's how I began to recover. I understand God today in a very simple way. I understand God as a source of energy available at all times in as much abundance as I'm willing to accept. As a matter of fact, I sort of understand myself as a light bulb, and I can choose on any given day to plug into that source of energy, and I can choose to be a 40-watt bulb or a 100-watt bulb or a floodlight. That source of energy never says to me, I'm sorry, you've been a bad girl. You can only be a nightlight today. That source of energy never judges me. It never compares me. There's only one source of judgment and comparison that I'm aware of today, and that's my ego. It does a very good job at judging and comparing. And I have a lot of conversations with my ego. A woman at Fallen Leaf Lake, the conference where Tony and I met, said it beautifully. I have learned about judgment by judging. Joe actually said it too, in a different way. I have learned about judging by saying, how can she do that? I then almost immediately have an opportunity to find out. That source of energy, as I understand it, which works through me and through you, brings into my life everything that I judge so that I will know how it feels, how it looks, and what it's like to walk in those shoes. That's the nature of judgment. That's how I am beginning to fall out of my need to judge you. When I say I'll never do something, I'll never do this or that or the other thing, I create the opportunity to have that experience in a very simple way. I draw it to me by saying I'll never do it. I create the energy. I use the energy. I become a source that draws to me everything I judge. That's exactly how I've learned in recovery about my ego, my rational mind, those parts of me that can make my life go very smoothly, those parts of me that can make my life real tough, real hard. All of my suffering is a direct result of my addiction. My recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous and my elimination of drugs and alcohol from my life was just the beginning of my discovery of my addictions. I also suffer from a disease of demanding. I demand certain things from life, and life is just being life. And my opportunity is to be just me. But every once in a while, I forget and my ego gets out of hand. A friend of mine suggested once that I could get a U-Haul, little U-Haul trailer to carry my ego with me. Rather than get a U-Haul, I've tried to work with it. I've tried to become friends with it. I've tried to understand what my ego believes we need. It believes we need a lot. Now, the interesting thing about that belief, the belief that we need a lot, that's the belief that actually got me sober. So you see, it's very hard to know quite what to eliminate, because my need turned out to be a need for you. I thought I needed drugs and alcohol. What I needed was you. And in finding you, I began very slowly to rediscover me. That's what I lost in my life of addiction. Addiction, as I understand it today, is a trip into unconsciousness and unawareness. Recovery is the process reversed, a trip into consciousness and awareness. Coming to know more about who I am, why I do what I do, and how I can be more clear in what I say and what I do. I really have only one desire tonight, and that is to share what you have given me, my insides, the part of me that was dead when I got to you and lives now. That's what I'd most like to show you. That's what I eliminated with morphine and scotch. My drugs of choice, everybody has a drugs of choice. Mine were morphine and scotch. I had quite remarkable ways to get those drugs. I worked for veterinarians. I hit the streets. I did whatever was necessary to gather the drugs that allowed me not to participate in my life. I was, for many years of my life, a moral coward. I did not want to be a part of this life experience. I know some of the reasons today why I was so frightened. And I understand that the first few years of my sobriety, I was equally afraid. But living with that fear, coming to recognize and understand that fear, is how I managed to really begin to recover. And I use the word recover very specifically because I have recovered my life. I've recovered my heart. I've recovered my feelings. I hid in my intellect so long, and I continue to do that a lot. Simple example of how well I hid in my intellect is that I spent 18 years in college. I have a PhD. A man in Laguna named Chuck helped me understand a little about my PhD. He said, "Cindy, honey, you know what BS is." And I said, "Yes." He said, "An MS is more of the same. And a PhD is piled higher and deeper." That degree on my wall today taught me a very valuable lesson. It is not so much a sign of my success as it is a symbol of my sheer terror of failure. That fear of failure has driven me for many years. Those of you who have come to terms with your fear of failure understand addiction. You know what drove you to drinking and to drugs. And the more I go into my fear of failure, the more I understand why it's such an illusion. It's such a lost endeavor. There is nothing to fear, and there's no way to fail. There's no way to do this wrong. Did you know that? I mean, we say a lot of things to each other. We give each other a lot of hard time. In the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, thank God, it does not say, do not get emotionally involved. We, however, say that to each other because we have such a fear of failure. I would like to say to you tonight that I am here because I got emotionally involved in Alcoholics Anonymous almost immediately. I would also like to say to you that I experienced great pain, remarkable suffering. I was, as a matter of fact, taken to bed before I was taken to my first meeting. God, as I understand God, knew how I would come to you. There have not been any mistakes in my life. I sat down on a January day in 1972 next to a stranger in a restaurant. There was one seat available at a counter in a restaurant in Kansas City, Missouri. A huge restaurant filled with people, one seat available. I sat down in that seat next to a handsome man. My life has been run by handsome men. I have given them almost all of my power. I have in the last few years taken some of it back. I still have to remember, as I'm giving it away, that I want to take it back today. There is still a part of me that would like for a handsome man to save my ass and then take care of it. But I know today that it's my job, and it's a job that I do more fully each day. So I sat down next to this handsome man and tried to eat, which I was not very good at doing, choked and gagged on my food, and after making every effort, he turned to me and he said, "It looks like you've had a hard time." And I sort of shook my head and turned away. And he said, I understand. I'm an alcoholic. And I said, well, I'm not. I'm a drug addict. And he said, well, you smell funny. And I said, well, I drink to stay off drugs. He said, does it work? And I said, no, not very well. And he said, I have something that might help you. Why don't you come with me? Those words have been the guiding light of my life. Why don't you come with me? I had followed men for many years previous to that. I had absolutely nothing to lose. He looked very clear-eyed and fearless. Those were the words I used to describe people in those days who looked like they had it all together. And I said that with great disdain because, like Joe, I had a terminal case of the cool. I looked down my nose at people as they were looking down their noses at me. That is the disease of addiction. He took and may have gotten here in that way that for a number of years I was very uncomfortable about the way I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. He also was uncomfortable about the way he brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous. A lot of his friends gave him a very hard time about the way he brought women to Alcoholics Anonymous. As far as I know, at last count, there were 12 women sober in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous because of his efforts. I think he does a remarkable job salvaging human lives. Now, I began my journey with you. And after a fairly short time, several months, I went to an AA convention, and I met yet another man who was the Saturday night speaker. I had a great fondness for Saturday night speakers in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he was the Saturday night speaker. His name was Tom A., and we fell in love, and we began a journey together that was to last some years. Tom and I were very good for each other. During our life together, we worked with a lot of people in this fellowship. We grew day by day in sobriety. He wrote and published 4 books. I completed my PhD at the University of California. We brought out a lot of very good things in each other, one day at a time. We were sort of the perfect AA couple. And we shared a lot of those years with Bob. And in the summer of 1977, Tom came to me and said, "I think there's some difficulty in our relationship. I'm going to move down the street and see what's going on." I was amazed. I had absolutely no idea that anything was wrong at all. As far as I could tell, it was a marriage made in heaven. I still believe that today. I know that the marriage was made in heaven, and I know that the divorce was made in heaven. We came together for a perfect period of time, and our life together ended right on time. Tom gave me the greatest gift I could have ever received in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. He taught me about another level of addiction. Based on the severity of my withdrawal when Tom left, I was very heavily addicted to him. As a matter of fact, I believed that he was fully and totally responsible for my happiness, for my sobriety, for my peace of mind, for my confidence in the future. I had no idea that those were parts of me. I believed they were in him. No wonder he had to go. He carried a very heavy burden. I expected him to make me happy, and it was never his job. That's my job. And he gave me back my job. My heart absolutely broke when Tom left. I cried for days. I had 4.5 years of sobriety. I was absolutely shocked that I fell apart. I had worked the program to the best of my ability. I spent a lot of time with Chuck, whining, sniveling, sobbing, saying, "I've been such a good girl. I've tried so hard." And he said, "My dear, please realize you didn't come into this for a good deal. You came into it for sobriety, and that's what you've got." And that's what I had. I mean, to go through an experience like that, stark, staring, sober, is quite remarkable. I know today that my heart broke so that it could open. It began to open in the summer of 77. I went one day from being a happily married student living on the beach in Southern California, laughing and playing day after day, to being a single professor living in the desert in Arizona. And I had absolutely nothing to do with it. As far as I could tell, it was an extremely valuable lesson that my life seems to be none of my business. As Woody Allen says, 80% of life is just showing up. That's all I know to do today is just show up. Report for duty, ask for a little guidance and direction. For a long time, I only did a part of the 11th step. I prayed for the knowledge of God's will for me and then wondered where it was. That's only half of it. Today, when I pray for the knowledge of God's will for me, I know that that's what I have the rest of the day, all day long. My will and God's will are not separate. God's will for me is the same as any source of energy. that I have the opportunity to express myself in any way I want. I know, standing here tonight, that God loved me as much drunk as he does sober. I have never disappointed God. I am here tonight because of a power greater than myself, because of the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I also know that God can't keep me sober, AA can't keep me sober, because it is my job to do. My disease of demanding demanded that you make me happy. My disease of demanding asked that somewhere outside of me something work. Some combination of drugs, some man, some job, some automobile, somebody, something outside of me fill me up. It's an impossible demand. It can't be fulfilled. That's why it's such an endless, frustrating, hopeless journey. Alcoholics Anonymous can't keep me sober. It is a tool that offers me a life of sobriety. It is an opportunity that I pick up. It is a challenge that I meet on a daily basis. I live today an AA way of life. I began to really learn how to do that in the desert. Somehow, if you can survive in the desert, I feel, you can survive anywhere. It's sort of like I heard a woman from General Service Office in New York say, if you can stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, you can stay sober anywhere. I'm beginning to understand that more each day. So I began to stay sober in the desert, living alone in a funny little house, teaching at the University of Arizona. The job that I had at that point in time made sense out of 15 years of drug addiction and alcoholism and 18 years of education, because I became an assistant professor in the addiction studies program, a two-year master's program teaching people how to work in drug and alcohol treatment. So all of a sudden, a whole lot of years that had made absolutely no sense came together in the way my life always seems to do if I can just survive long enough. It comes together in a way that makes sense. Even I notice, even I comprehend how it makes sense, because it's finally so clear that I look at it and say, my God, it could not have happened any other way. That's why it didn't. That's why it happened exactly the way it happened. It absolutely had to. I wouldn't have understood it any other way. God's got to be within each one of us. That's why it happens so perfectly. And, of course, all around us, and in everybody else, and in everything else. So I began teaching, and I began learning. 3 years, I worked with the experience that I had with Tommy A. I worked with it. I tried to understand what had happened. I tried to understand what went wrong. I tried to understand how I had failed. I tried to justify how such a wonderful thing could end. And one day, I turned it all over. And what turn it over means to me is literally today to turn it over. The nature of wonderful things is to end so that another wonderful one can begin. The nature of lives together is that lives together change. Tom and I got a divorce. I have not seen him since the summer of 1977. He is a part of my life today because of what we experienced together. What we had together is a part of me. Therefore, he is a part of me. Our relationship didn't end. It just changed dramatically. And I changed dramatically, too. And I bless every day of that suffering. Ram Dass says, when you really realize that suffering brings grace, what can hurt you? Nothing can hurt you. my suffering comes as a direct result of my addiction, of my expectation. If I expect you to be anything but what you are, I'm going to get suffering. I'm asking for it. I'm begging for it. I want you to be who you are because today I have the blessing of being who I am. And I value it more every day. So why would I ever interfere with who you are? I want you to have the blessing of sobriety. I want you to have the blessing of drunkenness. If that is your path, I plan to start someday a drunk farm where people can die drunk when they want to. I think it's a privilege for some people to die that way. I think it's a privilege for those of us who can to live sober. And I bless that privilege on a daily basis because I came very close to dying drunk. That's why I value living sober. I couldn't have had what I have today without nearly dying drunk. Who am I to judge dying drunk? I have three very simple goals today. No judgment, no comparison, and no need to understand. My need to understand has nearly driven me crazy. I want to be free of it. That's how I come to understand. By being free of the need. After about a year in the desert, my prayer of 7 years was suddenly answered. All of my prayers are always answered exactly when I can handle the answer. Sometimes it takes a long time because I'm not yet ready for them to be answered. I prayed for a long time to be allowed to share in the life of my only son. I lost custody of him in 1970. I was declared an unfit mother by the state of Kansas and asked to leave, as a matter of fact. So for 7 years, I had prayed to have the opportunity to share in his life. And when I got to the desert and got what he called a real job, he came to live with me. If you have lost your children, and if you are saying a daily prayer to share some part of your lives with those children, let me suggest that you hold yourself in readiness. It will come to pass, and when it comes to pass, you will need every day of sobriety that you can gather. You will need every bit of strength, every bit of serenity, hope, peace, confidence in the future, everything you can gather from the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, gather it around you. When my son returned to my life, he was 14 years old. Within a very short time, overnight it seemed, he turned 16. He was 6'2". He weighed 210 pounds. He wore a size 13 shoe. And all we did was scream, fight, argue. I mean, I at this point had 6 years of sobriety. Anybody should have been better by then, right? Anybody should have grown more, should have been able to deal with a teenage son, especially one they had prayed to share with all those years. I could hardly stand the sight of him. He'd walk in the door and I'd get sick. I mean sick, physically sick, with fury and anger and rage. It was absolutely excruciating for both of us. Either I kicked him out or he was leaving, one or the other. It was in and out, back and forth. We only had one significant problem. I'm a sober drunken junkie and he's a practicing one. That's hard. It's hard to look into that mirror day after day. I can say to you, as I have already said, that every day of my life was essential to what I have tonight. Every drink I took, every fix I fixed, every part of it was essential. And I want to tell you, if I could prevent my son's pain, I would. That's crazy. You could not have prevented my pain. But I would deprive him of his right to suffer if I could. I'd lock him in a closet and I'd let him out when he was 22 and had a job in a bank and 2 kids. If I could do it, I would. Fortunately, that's not my business. Because I can tell you my life is none of my business. But now his life is my business. Right? Wrong. His life is none of my business. And he helped me learn more and more about that because 2.5 years ago he joined the Army. He went through basic training. He went into aircraft repair school or something like that, and I hadn't heard from him for a month or so, and he called, and he said, "Mother, I just wanted to tell you I got my wings this afternoon." And I said, "What are those for?" He said, "Well, I am now a paratrooper." I said, "You're a what?" He said, "Yes, I've been jumping out of airplanes for the last month." I said, "Oh, my God, in heaven." He said, "Mother, it's too late to worry." I said, "Oh, I guess you're right." He has gotten to know me quite well in the short time we've been together. He called me 2 weeks before Christmas. He is due back into the United States. He's been in Germany for a year and a half. He is being sent back to Fort Polk, Louisiana, because he was busted from PFC to, from whatever he was to what he is now. And there's a very simple reason why that happened. He was drunk on duty. He blew it all. The year and a half that he put together of achievement and accomplishment, he snuffed it out like that. It's so excruciatingly painful when I really think about it that I sort of go right through it, out the other side of the pain, because I can hardly stand what's in front of him. After my mother was with me at Christmas and we got that telephone call and I put down the phone with the tears running down my face and the tears running down her face, and she said, "Honey, it looks like we're going to go through it all again." I said, "Yeah, it does." We have gone through it a lot in my family. That's the nature of the disease. In 1969, my 30-year-old brother blew his brains out. He couldn't shut it up enough with drugs and alcohol, so he blew it away. He couldn't take it. And I understand that. I had prayed for the knowledge of God's will for him for a long, long time, and then when I got it, I didn't want it. I didn't want it to be that way, and that, too, is none of my business. That's his business. 2 days after his funeral, I picked up the telephone and called Alcoholics Anonymous, and I told them that I needed them to come and help my father. One thing I did learn from you is that some people are too close for me to help, and my father was too close for me to help. So Alcoholics Anonymous sent the perfect person to come and see my father. He drove up in the driveway in a more expensive car than my father drives, with a sticker on the windshield from a better neighborhood than my father lives in. He was about 4 years younger than my dad. Not too much younger, just enough younger. He had a better suntan. He was in much better shape. He swept into my father's living room with a book, Alcoholics Anonymous, under his arm. He put his arms around my dad, and he said to my dad almost exactly the same words that were said to me: "Come with us, we'll love you back into loving yourself." My father will celebrate his 5th year of continuous sobriety this March. It has been a remarkable journey for him. He knows that my brother died so he could live. That's really something for a 70-year-old man to be with day after day. And he's with it, and he's sober with it. He doesn't understand it. We have talked a lot about losing our need to understand. There are some things I do not understand. I do know today that there are no mistakes and no accidents, and that every ending has within it a new beginning. That every time I get caught up in an ending, it's up to me to start looking for the new beginning, to start focusing my attention on what is starting in my life After about 3 years of loneliness in the desert and work at the university, I met a lovely, beautiful man. I had said to myself and to anyone who would listen, and from podiums like this, that I would never, under any circumstances, get involved with a married man during sobriety. You must realize by now how I created the opportunity to do that. How predictable it was that a married man would walk into my life. And he did, through a series of totally strange and bizarre circumstances. He walked into my life. We fell in love. He got a divorce. We went through a remarkable series of events. Watch people in Alcoholics Anonymous when you go through something like that. I know some of you have had that opportunity. And you will notice who moves to you with love and support and who moves away with judgment and condemnation. It was hard for me at that time not to take that personally. I know a little more today how not to take that personally. I have learned a lot about using the world to learn about myself. As a matter of fact, let me suggest a little strategy that I have found extremely useful. I happen to agree with my friend Chuck. If you take more than one inventory, you're bragging. But there's a very important way that I have discovered to learn a lot about myself. We say to each other, don't take other people's inventory. I would like to recommend that, as a matter of fact, you sit down with a pad of paper and a pencil and take everybody you know's inventory. Okay? Take your mother's inventory, take your father's inventory, take your sponsor's inventory, take your best friend's inventory. Take it as carefully as you can. Leave out absolutely nothing in detail. Then take a red pen, go back through those inventories and cross out their name and put in yours. You will have, I guarantee you, a searching and fearless moral inventory. You will also have a wonderful, exciting new picture of yourself. It will give you a whole new set of things to work with. It helped me see that I have never been punished for my defects of character. I have been punished very effectively by them. They do fine punishing me, like Joe said, until I can't stand them anymore, and I drop them. That's how a power greater than myself removes them. He lets me do it, because it's my job. He lets me learn from them. God, as I understand, God wouldn't take anything away from me that I was learning with or using. That source of energy doesn't make judgments like that. He gives me the opportunity to kill myself or heal myself. That is my job, my responsibility. Responsibility is a new word to me today. It means, very simply, my ability to respond appropriately to life as it comes. That's my responsibility. I tried to give it away for a long time. I wanted you to define my life. I projected all of my defects of character onto you and then judged you for being such a creep. That's how I gave myself away. That's how I lost who I am. I projected it out on you and then stayed away from you. I'm trying today, I am today, taking those projections back. I'm finding out about me by how I judge you. That's me judging you, not you. Now, it turns out to help me not take things so personally also, because when you judge me, it's you judging you, not me. Right? I mean, if it works for me, it works for you. It has set me free of a lot of fear. My fear of failure has grown smaller and smaller. How could I fail? There's no contest. I'm not competing. In what way can I blow it? The only way I can blow it is not to show up. And I like showing up. my life never changes gently. I guess I wouldn't pay attention if it did. It changes quickly and dramatically. And I've been teaching at the University of Arizona for about 6 years, and this summer I got a telephone call from Laguna Beach, California, a place I thought I would never return, from a man that I had worked with at the university, asking me if I'd be interested in a new job. I talked with Bart. We still have a relationship, by the way, in spite of all the people who said it would never last because it was built on other people's broken hearts. It has lasted up to and including today, one day at a time. Barton and I have absolutely no intention today of getting married. We have a private commitment that we honor one day at a time. We don't feel the need today to make it public. We have all the children we're going to have. I told you about mine. His are his problem. So today, we're together each day for one very simple reason. Because we want to be. We're not bound together by any ropes or strings. We are together because we happen to enjoy our lives together. When I got this job offer in Southern California, I said to Bart, "Would you like to come?" After a lot of thought, it meant he had to leave his profession at the university, come to Southern California, very vague, unknown possibilities. After a few weeks of thought, he decided to come along. So in a very quick period of time, I left the university. We left our one-acre ranchette in Tucson, Arizona, and I went back to the beach in Southern California. Interesting kind of cycle, isn't it? Does it mean anything to you? I haven't figured it out yet, but then I'm trying not to need to understand, right? And the job that I have today is as a psychologist in a dependency treatment unit. So I am now doing what I have been teaching people how to do for the last 6 years. And what it reminds me of is a funny, musty, little, dowdy professor sitting in an office for 6 years reading a book on how to ride a bicycle. And now she just got on it. She's fallen off of it a lot. She has bloody knees and elbows. Because it's a hell of a bicycle. Doing what I've been teaching people how to do. You know, they say that people who do, do, and people who can't teach. I may go back to teaching tomorrow. Working in dependency treatment is a daily challenge. I have a strange feeling after the phone call from my son for what I am being prepared. But I don't want to call that into my life any sooner than it's coming. Today, I look forward to my life every morning. I can't wait to see what's going to happen. I feel a sense of frustration sometimes where I work because I sort of see it as a race. Is he going to stay sober long enough to find out how exciting it is before he gets drunk and knocks out how exciting it is? That's the race. Can you hang around long enough to feel the excitement, to feel the light, the enlightenment, the enthusiasm? Can you hang around just long enough? If you'll just stay sober long enough for it to grab you, it will grab you. Just the way it grabbed me. It's just a race. Will your consciousness get stimulated before your unconsciousness wins? That's the trick, is to just hang around long enough for AA to get you, for God to get you, for us to get you, for somebody to walk into your heart. Your heart will break. So it can open, so people can walk in and say, "Hello. We've come to love you. We've come to share with you. I have had a spiritual awakening as a direct result of these steps. Thank you for allowing me to share the message I have found."